Case number 07-5195. Peter James Etherton, Appellant versus District of Columbia, Office of the Mayor, et al. Ms. Campbell for the amicus curiae. Ms. Kidwell for the Appellee DOJ. Mr. Love for Appellee's District of Columbia, et al.
Good morning, Your Honor, and may it please the Court. I'm James Coleman. I'm one of the co-directors of the Duke Appellate Litigation Clinic. The Court appointed me as an amicus to appear on behalf of the appellant, Mr. Etherton. Sarah Campbell, a third-year law student and a member of the clinic, will argue on behalf of the amicus.
Thank you very much.
May it please the Court. The appellant Peter James Etherton was summarily and permanently discharged from a District of Columbia Superior Court grand jury on April the 11th, 2001. He received no notice or opportunity to be heard prior to his discharge, and no judge was involved in the decision. Mr. Atherton's removal from this grand jury threatened the independence of the grand jury and violated his constitutional rights. Now, the specific issue that this case presents is whether jury officer Suzanne Bailey Jones with the District of Columbia court system and Assistant U.S. Attorney Daniel Zakim are entitled to absolute immunity for their participation.
Well, that's one of the defenses that's raised, but another defense that's raised is qualified immunity.
That's correct, Your Honor. The district court decided the case on the basis of absolute immunity.
Oh, but that doesn't make any difference, right?
That's
review
true, Your Honor.
Complete review de novo here.
I'm prepared to address both absolute immunity and qualified immunity.
I think qualified immunity is a greater problem for you, so.
Can you, just before you go to that, can you answer whether if Chief Judge King had been the one discharging, your position would be the same here, correct? In other words, he doesn't receive absolute immunity either.
Your Honor, it's under one analysis, he wouldn't receive immunity because this isn't a classic a judicial act or classic adjudication, such as the acts that have been afforded immunity by the Supreme Court and by this court. But under another analysis, if this court were to find that a judge would be entitled to absolute immunity for this function because it's inherent in the judicial process and the court has inherent supervisory authority or authority to discipline grand jurors in this manner, it would still be possible for this court to find that Ms. Bailey Jones is not entitled to absolute immunity. And that's because if we look to this court's opinion in Wagshall versus Foster, under the three-part analysis, we look at whether the function that the nature of the function that was performed.
If you're looking at the nature of the function, it shouldn't matter whether the judge did it.
Well, that is possibly true, Your Honor, but under under a slightly more nuanced analysis, it's possible that since this is a case of quasi-judicial immunity, where we're not affording immunity to the judge himself, but to judicial personnel, in the cases where this court has recognized or extended immunity in that manner, it's because the judicial personnel were acting as bona fide arms of the court. For example, in Syndrome versus Suda, for example, this court there extended immunity to clerks. Now, those clerks were acting as arms of the judge and helping the judge research cases and write opinions.
Clearly judicial functions.
Clearly judicial
functions. Now, how about, does your rule here extend to peremptory challenges in trial courts such that judges and prosecutors could be sued and brought into court for damages actions for peremptory challenges that a discharged juror thought was based on an improper ground?
No, Your Honor. It doesn't have to extend that far. The grand jury
What's the logical distinction? Because I thought you were relying on Ex parte Virginia, and that was really about trial jurors as well.
Well, Ex parte Virginia was about trial jurors, and the point that was to be gleaned from that case is that actions related to jurors are ministerial in nature or administrative in nature and therefore not classic adjudication so as to warrant absolute immunity. But the distinction is that peremptory challenges are built into the judicial process. They're performed in open court, and they take place in the context of a trial, a petit jury, not the grand jury. The grand jury is different than a petit jury in that it's meant to be independent from either the prosecutor or the court.
Can I take you a step back?
Yes, Your Honor.
Explain your liberty interest.
The liberty interest here is an interest in deliberating as an impaneled grand juror.
And where are you finding this?
This liberty interest is derived both from constitutional principles and D.C. case law and rules. The first thing I...
Derived in a way that we would have known it before this case?
Yes, Your Honor.
What's your best source? Where is it?
Well, there are several...
This goes right to the heart of your qualified immunity.
That's right, Your Honor. It, under the Supreme Court's guidance as to qualified immunity, it must be apparent in light of pre-existing law that this conduct was unlawful. And there are several sources of law that make that apparent in this case. The first that I would point your attention to is D.C. Superior Court Rule of Criminal Procedure 6G. Now, that provision gives authority to the chief judge or another judge designated by the chief judge to excuse an impaneled grand juror. That authority is expressly...
As the Supreme Court said that state rules, even statutes that merely set forth procedural prescriptions do not rise to the substantive liberty interest. So why would we assume that is a constitutional liberty or constructs a constitutional liberty interest?
Well, Your Honor, it's true that procedures themselves don't establish a liberty interest. This court has been clear in that in the Brandon case, that you can't assert a liberty interest in the procedures themselves. But that's not what Mr. Atherton is asserting a liberty interest in. It's not the procedures themselves. It's that the Rule 6G, for example, by allowing discharge but only for cause creates
four
an expectation. It's
four cause.
It's the four cause. Yes, right. Your Honors. It's
that
both
creates
an assignment.
If that creates anything, it's a property interest.
Well, it's
at least in traditional procedural due process cases that we would assume that was a property, but you haven't argued that.
Mr. Atherton has argued that in his briefs. The amicus brief did not pursue the property interest analysis, but that the principle that limiting official discretion to only for cause creates an expectation or entitlement to something is applicable in the liberty interest context in addition to property interest.
What cases say that?
Well, Your Honor, I don't have a case translating that from the property interest context to the liberty interest context precisely, but the liberty interest that we're discussing here, an interest in jury service, is quite different than liberty interests such as the interest in being free from bodily restraint, other more typical liberty interests. This is more analogous to something like voting. It's a privilege. As the Supreme Court pointed out in Powers versus Ohio, for many people, the honor and privilege of jury duty is the most significant opportunity to participate in the democratic process. And it's that language, that recognition that this is an important democratic privilege analogous to voting.
Are you trying to argue? I mean, saying it that way doesn't really get you. There's not much content to that. It's kind of a nice thing. It might happen to me. I'm not sure how that becomes a liberty interest. Are you trying to say more that you cannot be excluded from it because of your views?
Just to clarify.
D.C., I think you cited, or I think there is D.C. case law suggesting you can't be excluded from grand jury service because of your personal views. Is that right?
Well, Your Honor, there's a D.C. code provision, section 11-1908, that prohibits the exclusion of individuals or a class of individuals from being considered for jury service. And there is that we contend applies just to individuals being summoned for jury service, but doesn't specifically address the situation of dismissing an impaneled juror. Now, there's also case law both from the D.C. Circuit and at the D.C. Court level that indicates that it's improper to dismiss a deliberating juror on the basis of his or her views on the merits. That principle is well established. And
that's radically different, right?
It's
not.
that principle acknowledges that discretion to remove a juror, a deliberating juror, is to be exercised with caution. And to remove a deliberating juror without any form of procedural safeguards to determine whether the cause for removal is permissible or, on the other hand, impermissible, such as on the basis of views on the merits, to remove a juror in that way clearly goes against that principle. And it's the combination of the D.C. Rule of criminal procedure, along with this case law discussing the removal of a juror on the basis of his or her views on the merits, that creates an expectation on Mr. Atherton's part that he would not be removed from the grand jury without some kind of procedure.
It's a good argument, but do you think it's clearly established at the time this happened?
Yes, Your Honor. The provisions that I pointed out and the case law that I've discussed were on the books. They were clear to a reasonable officer, such that, and let me be clear that we're not saying that there's an unqualified right to continue deliberating on the grand jury regardless of what happens. What we're contending is that there's a right to procedural due process, to have a
What cases established the content of that process at the time these occurred?
Well, Mullane versus Central Hanover Bank, Your Honor, a Supreme Court case.
That clearly determined that there must be a judge and a hearing deciding this issue?
No, Your Honor, but that case.
I didn't get that out of Mullane.
That case does say that at a minimum, once a liberty or property interest is established, that at a minimum, notice and an opportunity to be heard are required, and neither were afforded here.
Well, in some cases, post-deprivation process can suffice. Including suits under state law. I know that hasn't been raised by the appellees here, but in some cases, post-deprivation process is enough.
That's true, Your Honor. But in this situation, where Mr. Atherton no longer has a right to deliberate on that grand jury, and where the independence of that grand jury was threatened, a post-deprivation remedy is really inadequate. What is required
if this hearing is to be much of a hearing, isn't it going to prevent the grand jury from going forward with any sort of dispatch?
No, Your Honor. We do not believe that the type of process that is due here would delay the grand jury's function. The D.C. Rule of Criminal Procedure 6G already requires that this function be performed by a judge, by the chief judge, or another judge.
That's separate from the question of the process. So would the chief judge have to bring in the other grand jurors and hear what they have to say about this, about Mr. Atherton?
The chief judge would have to undertake enough investigation and receive enough information to make a determination as to whether the removal was for a permissible cause.
How did we get to the chief judge? I understand under the D.C. rule, but what established that as a constitutional minimum?
As a constitutional minimum, we look to the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test. We look to the significance
of the
crime.
It was clearly determined at the relevant date under Matthews that only a judge could make this determination.
Well, Your Honor, the nature of the Matthews versus Eldridge balancing test is such that it always requires some balancing. And so we would either have to say that the process that is due could never be clearly established because it always requires a balancing test, or recognize that there is a minimum of process that must be due.
And including a judge? I mean, there are a huge number of administrative determinations that go on without being determined by judges. So, I mean, it is quite a escalation to have a judge as the minimum constitutional requirement.
Your Honor, this court could find that.
I didn't think that was your argument.
I thought your argument was that that Mr. Zakim himself conceded that it was inappropriate for him to be involved in it.
Well, Mr. Zakim, in an email that he wrote to Ms. Bailey Jones, which is found at pages 61 and 62 of the joint appendix, indicated that he was aware that he was hearing matters that touched upon the deliberative process, and for that reason, it was inappropriate for him to take a position on the matter.
All right, so your argument is that insofar as he's concerned, I thought your argument was there can be no dispute there. Whatever process was due, he couldn't be part of it.
That's correct, Your Honor, or that it would have to be exercised in such a way as to ensure that the independence of the grand jury wasn't threatened. Just going back to your point, Your Honor, about what process was due here and whether a judge has to be involved, this court could find that someone other than a judge could perform this function. Right. We're not saying that that's absolutely necessary.
You're just saying
necessary.
There was no process given.
There was no process. Yeah. There was no process at all, no notice or opportunity to be heard. And this could be performed in such a way that someone else could do it, but the independence of the grand jury must be maintained at all times. As I see that I'm into my rebuttal time, are there any further questions?
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The federal appellees have two legal issues in this case. First, whether Assistant United States Attorney Daniel Zakim is entitled to absolute immunity in this case, or in any event, whether he is entitled to qualified immunity. The Supreme Court's recent case of Vandekamp versus Goldstein is directly on point on the issue of absolute immunity. In Vandekamp, the court held that two supervisors who were performing administrative duties were entitled to absolute prosecutorial immunity because their duties were intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process.
I thought that was intimately connected with the trial.
In that case, it was, Your Honor.
Well, I didn't read the court to say that any time you're connected with whatever goes on in the judiciary, you get absolute immunity. That would have been a stunning decision. They were confining it to within the, they clearly broadened to some extent, but I thought they were talking about within the context of trial.
In that fact situation, they were, Your Honor.
Well, that's one way to read precedent.
But there is a long line of cases.
Look at the facts of the case. There's no line of precedent that says we're going to give absolute immunity outside of the context of trial.
No, Your Honor.
All right, so
this most recent
case is still within that confine.
Your Honor, if I may address your first question. First of all, when you're talking about the judicial phase of the criminal process in this case, the grand jury is included in that. This is not limited to just trial situations.
This isn't presentation of argument to the grand jury or questioning of witnesses to the grand jury or presentation of evidence to the grand jury. It's an administrative part of the job, which is the who's going to sit on the grand jury, like personnel decisions, right?
Personnel decisions, I agree with you, are administrative functions. That's not what was at issue here. What it was at issue here.
Well, if you go back to Ex parte Virginia, it's interesting. It seems that the Supreme Court, both for judicial immunity and prosecutorial immunity, has considered jurors and grand jurors somewhat like they treat personnel decisions, which are on the administrative side of the line. It's not a perfect analogy, of course, but it seems if you go back to look at Ex parte Virginia, it's clearly on the administrative side of the line, which would apply to both claims for absolute immunity here.
Your Honor, there's in Butts, the principle of absolute immunity was extended to even agencies that are engaged in certain types of adjudication type of.
Depends on the function.
Yes, it does. Right.
And you say.
And the function here of Daniel Zakim was supervisor of the grand juror. And within the realm of his responsibilities was. When he was alerted to a problem with the grand jury, within the realm of his responsibilities, it was entirely appropriate for him to report this problem to the proper authority. And that's what he did in this case. He properly reported to the Superior Court that he had been alerted to a problem with the grand jury.
That's really a merits question.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
That's really a merits question.
It's also a qualified immunity.
And a qualified immunity question. But suppose we conclude that there's no absolute judicial immunity, going back to Ex parte Virginia and looking at that line of cases. How can there be absolute prosecutorial immunity if that's the case?
Number one, Daniel Zakim did not remove Peter Atherton from the grand jury. And that's an undisputed fact in this case. Mr. Atherton himself alleged in the complaint that what Daniel Zakim did was to essentially tell him to report to the Superior Court, to Mr. Wynn.
Well, that doesn't determine whether or not there's absolute or qualified immunity. Again, you're fighting the merits. You may be right, but that's not a reason why we would invoke absolute immunity.
Well, Your Honor, what I'm getting at is that it was entirely appropriate and within the realm of his responsibilities as a criminal prosecutor in the grand jury section to report that.
It would be absolutely, appropriate for Dan Zakim to tell one of his supervisees that they couldn't have sick leave.
But that's an administrative...
Well, but that's the whole point here. This looks administrative as well. I mean, so to say that it was absolutely appropriate for Dan Zakim to do something is not to answer the question as to whether or not what he did deserves absolute immunity.
Your Honor, it was...
Absolute immunity is rare. And I don't see anything in the court's most recent case that disturbs that notion. Vandekamp doesn't disturb that notion.
Your Honor, we submit that it does. What Vandekamp did is, for the first time, made a distinction between those type of administrative duties, such as you've suggested, and that is a personnel matter, versus those that are connected to a trial in that case. But the long line of cases really talks about
let's
a judicial phase
let's
of the criminal
process. Do it this way, in the little time you have left. What's the best passage in Vandekamp from your point of view, where the court says this is not limited to trial settings? We mean to go much more broadly than that. Where is that? I missed it.
We are.
But that's not to say that it's not there.
It quotes Imbler in a long line of cases which talks about absolute immunity because their duties were, and I quote, intimately associated with the judicial phase of the criminal process.
Right,
it does not limit it to trial.
They're talking about the trial context in all these cases. We do look at the cases and what they involve. Now, I'm just trying to figure out where you think you can find authority that takes us out of that broad...
Out of the trial?
The broad trial context, yes.
Your Honor, the initiation of a prosecution in the Moore versus Valder case, you were looking at a prosecutor who, in fact, had submitted, who had manipulated evidence in a grand jury. And certainly in that context, he was granted absolute immunity despite how serious that was. So the grand jury process
on
is
the
not
presentation of evidence with respect to a potential trial.
Yes, okay. With respect to the grand jury.
With respect to a potential trial, potential prosecution, right?
Is there any precedent? Sorry to interrupt. Precedent suggesting that prosecutors have absolute immunity with respect to the selection or removal of jurors, grand jurors or trial jurors?
Not that I. Well, Your Honor, yes. We cited the Fields case in which a prosecutor was granted absolute immunity out of the Second Circuit. And in that case...
That was not about removal of a grand jury, right?
It was a number of things, not for removal.
It was related to the grand juror.
Yes.
I'm talking really real precise about the selection or removal of jurors or grand jurors.
No, Your Honor, it did not. We have no case that talks about removal, and as I'll indicate again, Dan Zakim did not remove the Mr. Atherton.
Well, but he's alleged to have participated in the removal. I mean, at this stage, that's what we have to accept. Obviously, he doesn't cause the removal under the D.C. law, but the allegation here is that he participated and was a contributing cause or conspired for the removal. Those are the allegations, so we take those for now.
Your Honor, in any event, Daniel Zakim would be entitled to qualified immunity.
Okay.
Because there was no clearly established constitutional right.
I tried to get you there about 10 minutes ago.
There was no clearly established constitutional right.
What about equal protection? Now, suppose this is racial discrimination. It seems that it's been clearly established, and even one of the motivating purposes of the Civil Rights Amendments was to protect jurors and protect people in voting from racial discrimination. That's not clearly established?
Your Honor, first of all, the district court did not indicate that a claim had been stated against, an equal protection claim had been stated against Daniel Zakim. Secondly, we submit that
complete review de novo. Don't worry.
It's a de novo review. We look at the complaint. The district court just didn't address it. We're looking at this de novo.
If you look at it for purposes of the complaint, Your Honor, that allegation is not only not plausible, but it's very speculative.
Okay, but if it's alleged, let's assume.
What he alleges in that case is that
the grand it's alleged. Let's assume an equal protection claim is alleged. And on qualified immunity, is it clearly established that someone cannot be removed from a grand jury
on the
basis of race? It's not clearly established?
It is not clearly established.
It's been established since 1880, yep. Strouder.
Yeah, you
really from 18.
Really don't mean to make that argument.
Really from 1868, but
I thought your answer there was a pleading argument, that the pleading was inadequate.
Yes, Your Honor, that is my argument.
But that's it. If the pleading's adequate, you have no argument on the equal protection, right? You have no argument. You surely don't mean to suggest that we still are in a day where people can be excluded from a grand jury on the basis of race?
Your Honor, I will go back to my argument before in that Mr. Zakim did not remove the
We understand your argument on the merits. Yes. We're talking about a motion to dismiss. We're talking about whether there's anything left on the complaint.
And when you look at the complaint, Your Honor, you will see that what Peter Atherton alleged was that it was the grand jurors who became upset with him.
Right,
Spanish.
Again, you're going back to the allegations. I'm just trying to say, assuming an equal protection claim was alleged, and in the end of the gray brief from amicus, they said, with respect to qualified immunity, it should go without saying that it was clearly established that officials cannot lawfully discriminate against jurors on the basis of their ethnicity, and defendants do not appear to dispute this. I didn't think you disputed this.
No, we don't dispute that.
Okay.
We dispute that Daniel Zakim.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Richard Love. I represent the District of Columbia, Mr. Delaney, Mr. Wynn, and Ms. Bailey-Jones.
Can we get the easy stuff out first? I assume you don't dispute the last point either, right?
I do not dispute the last point either. It's clearly established that she couldn't be removed for within ethnic animus. But I think there are two points that we have raised in our brief. With regard to qualified immunity on the equal protection claim. The first is that it's waived. Mr. Atherton did respond to the District of Columbia defendant's motions to dismiss. Ms. Bailey-Jones unquestionably raised qualified immunity. The district judge references it in his opinion, but it was clearly raised in the record. And he clearly responded to it. If you look at the appendix at pages 49 to 53, he goes on for five pages to argue why qualified immunity should be denied to Ms. Bailey-Jones. And nowhere in those five pages does he raise a word about his allegation that she had removed him for any ethnic animus. So we would submit that claim was waived by Mr. Atherton's failure to address it in the initial motion raising qualified immunity. Secondly, we do argue in the brief that an inference that Ms. Bailey-Jones acted with ethnic animus is not reasonably plausible from the facts in this complaint. In fact, the complaint is very detailed, and I think the details of the complaint contradict his request for alternative relief. And that alternative relief is that he was removed for ethnic purposes, as he states it in his complaint, and or for ethnic purposes. His first two primary reasons being his meticulous.
Well, it's mentioned.
It is mentioned.
It's a pro se complaint.
I understand that.
Says removed from the grand jury because of ethnicity, among other reasons.
That's correct, but
that's clearly established.
Right, but I think that the facts in the
complaint... Why shouldn't it just go back?
Well, the facts of the complaint belie that conclusion. I mean, doesn't support it. Indeed, I think it contradicts that conclusion. What he says is that the grand jury complained to Mr. Zakim, that he, quote, disrupted the grand jury proceedings when he delayed their deliberations, and that Mr. Zakim, quote, communicated this alleged disruption to Bailey Jones. And then he also asserts that Ms. Bailey Jones dismissed him because he was disruptive, or allegedly because he was disruptive. There's no allegation that Ms. Bailey Jones was aware of the hostility that Mr. Atherton allegedly felt when he thanked a witness in Spanish, that she was aware that he was a semi-fluent in Spanish or half Mexican. There's no allegation that Mr. Zakim even observed this incident or even was aware of this incident. He makes no mention of it in the email that is in the record.
Disparate treatment discrimination cases generally, you're often not going to have that at the time of the complaint, right?
Well, I understand that, but I'm saying the facts here, and I'm not simply going on the absence of what was not stated in the complaint. I think I'm relying on what was stated in the complaint, which contradicts and fails to support an inference of ethnic animus. With regard to the due process and substantive due process and procedural due process claims, they were not clearly established at the time of the events at issue in this case. And with regard to the Section 9...
Wasn't D.C. law pretty clear that you cannot be dismissed for your views? That you cannot be excluded from a grand jury or jury because...
Yes, but I don't... there are cases that clearly indicate that.
And rules as well.
Excuse me?
And rules as well.
Yes, but what was at issue here... I mean, what Mr. Atherton complains about is the process. There's nothing in the complaint that indicates anything as to his views.
Before you get to procedural due process, you have to figure out whether there's an entitlement created by local law. And I think the four clause and the views dismissal creates an entitlement. Then you figure out what processes do.
But you certainly allege those things.
Well, but the state... Here, the procedures, I think, don't create a liberty interest, certainly not a clearly established literal substance.
No, I'm talking about a substantive case law that says you cannot be removed because of your views with respect to a case.
And he doesn't allege that he was dismissed for his views. He alleges that he was dismissed for the because he objected to the process that the grand jurors were employing, that in his opinion they were too hasty in voting,
yeah,
that they didn't.
His views were different from what others were expressing in the grand jury. He's saying he was dismissed for that, and he had a right to express his views.
But not on the substance of any of the cases. It's not alleged that it's on his substantive views. And those same cases, I think Shadakari is one of them, clearly says we don't suggest, much less hold, that a juror could not be dismissed for being disruptive. And that's what is alleged here, that it wasn't on the substantive views on any particular case, but that the process as to how the grand jurors
were proceeding. We thought it was that he had alleged that it was for his substantive views. Is that a liberty, a protected interest under D.C. law? You're quibbling over what he alleged, and I'm trying to understand whether you're suggesting that that is not a liberty interest under D.C. law. Or
I don't think it was clearly established at the time.
Why? What else would you need other than what we've been talking about so far? That is the case law that's there and the rules that are there.
Well, the case law, I think, runs to a judge exercising particular caution into delving into the views of a juror when confronted with a decision as to whether to dismiss or excuse.
Let me ask it this way. Would any good U.S. attorney, in your view, or any good counsel or someone in this setting we're talking about, be confused about the principle that, no, you can't turn a person off because you think they have certain views about these matters. You cannot remove them. Would anyone be confused about that?
No, I agree with that.
Okay, so that's clear.
Right.
Okay. So then there's a liberty interest, which might support procedural due process.
We would argue here that again, the facts of the complaint do not...
Right, so you're not fighting the liberty interest. You agree there could be this liberty interest. You're saying he has not...
If it's confined to dismissal based on his views...
You're saying he didn't plead that, but you're not doubting there was a liberty interest that was known and understood.
Correct.
Okay.
In terms of the process that's due, isn't it questionable for the judicial official to rely solely on the word of the prosecutor in removing a grand juror? After all, prosecutors are... may not like certain grand jurors because they're not voting for indictments, and so it's a questionable process just to rely on the word of the prosecutor, isn't it?
Well, I think, you know, here we do have a record that includes a representation of what information the prosecutor imparted to Ms. Bailey Jones. I think nothing...
Right, I'm not talking so much about the facts of this case, but just in general in terms of the process that's due, assuming there is a due process interest here, if the process that's due would seem to require more than just hearing from the prosecutor before you discharge a grand juror, no?
Yes, and I think this case did prompt a change in procedure at the court, which now requires that... a situation of this nature would go to the chief judge to address. But we also have in the record an affidavit from the chief judge that says at the time, procedure didn't require that. It didn't require notice or consultation with this chief judge at the time. So the juror officer was really stuck with a report that a grand juror was bringing the process of the grand jury basically to a halt and disrupting it. And she made a decision.
Your argument is that that was adequate process if process was due.
I'm saying that her action in dismissing Mr. Atherton under these circumstances did not violate a clearly established constitutional right, and that she didn't knowingly violate the clearly established right.
Wait. Now we're confusing a lot of concepts because you've already conceded that if he's pleaded, I understand you're saying it's not there. If he has pleaded, his claim says, I was denied the opportunity to remain on that grand jury because of my views about the cases. That's a protected liberty interest, which would entitle him to procedural due process. You agree with that? So that's a pleading question now. So now let's assume he did plead it. Now what is your answer with respect to the denial of procedural due process? So now he's got a right to some process. Now, what is your argument now? If he's pleaded it.
Right. Well, under those circumstances, I think, again, we would, I think that would create a procedural due process problem. I think we have not, though, then gone back to the absolute immunity issue, which I think would...
Okay, on that, how do you deal with Ex parte Virginia?
Well, I think what Ex parte Virginia says, it says that the action of simply drawing up a list of jurors was merely a ministerial act, and they compared it to numerous functions, I think they say, as much so as the act of a roadmaster in selecting laborers to work upon the roads. Here, Miss Bailey Jones was not simply drawing up a list of jurors, a merely ministerial administrative task. She was exercising discretion.
There's absolute immunity for selecting the jurors, for removing the jurors, but not for selecting the jurors.
Well, I think it's not just selecting the jurors. He merely drew up a list of jurors in Ex parte Virginia. Here a decision was made, and I think this court in Wagshall said that a key feature of the task sheltered by judicial immunity is discretion, the exercise of discretion.
It was characterized in Forrester as just involving the selection of jurors. It wasn't limited in Forrester's summary of absolute immunity law. And described at length Ex parte Virginia, it didn't limit it in the way you're suggesting here. It just talked about the selection of jurors, trial jurors.
Right, but I think if you go back to Ex parte Virginia, that is what the judge there did. He drew up a list of jurors, excluding all colored citizens, and
Forrester has amplified that, and not limited.
Forrester amplified it insofar as it found that the dismissal of, I think it was a probation officer by the judge, was purely an administrative act. But I think the exercise of discretion is what distinguishes this from the purely administrative acts in both Forrester and in Ex parte Virginia. Here, Ms. Bailey Jones was confronted with this report of a disruptive juror. She had to make a decision. She could return him to the juror. She could defer him to another grand jury. She could excuse him, I think, pursuant to 11-1908-B1, and she did excuse him.
You think so? Judges have absolute immunity if they participate in the removal of grand jurors on the basis of race?
Well, I think that they would be protected. I think that absolute immunity provides that protection even when there are grave errors. And I think also in response perhaps to your initial question, I think if this same situation was or same act was committed by a judge, that it went to a judge instead of Ms. Bailey Jones, and the judge acted in the same manner that Ms. Bailey Jones did and summarily dismissed Mr. Atherton, that would be protected by absolute immunity.
Why?
And that the function...
Why?
Because it would have been exercising a judicial function, and that the protection would not be taken away simply because here it was exercised by the juror officer instead of a judge. It's not. It's the nature of the function, not the identity.
You say judicial function. Are you talking about something that a judge does?
No, because as you said in Forrester, the judge did not get immunity. But I don't think that the dismissal of
the tipping scale surely can't be because it's something that a judge does with discretion. That can't be it.
Well,
there are lots of things that we do. We have the exercise of discretion that wouldn't fit Forrester.
Well, I think that is a key element. I think this court said that in Wagshall. It's a key feature of the task sheltered by judicial immunity. I think I think it is an important element. I think that's what distinguished the denial of absolute immunity in the Antoine case as well, that the court reporters there were required to simply produce a verbatim transcript.
One of the issues that the cases have discussed is the prospect of vexatious litigation. That doesn't seem a real prospect in this circumstance, given the history of or the lack of cases that appear in the reporters, but I wanted to give you a chance to respond to that.
Well, I think, you know, we conceded there's not a volume of litigation, but I think we argued and that it would nonetheless, despite a possible smaller number of possible cases like this, would inhibit the juror officer or whoever might be the decision maker in this kind of situation from freely exercising their discretion in an appropriate and unrestrained manner. You know, and this could, well, I think that's the answer to your question. Thank you very much.
2 minutes for rebuttal.
A few brief points, Your Honors. First, I would, while we're on the topic of the Wagshall factors and what factors we look at in determining whether quasi-judicial immunity is warranted, the third of those factors is whether other procedural safeguards are in place so that constitutional rights will be protected in some manner. And here, there is no right to appeal that Atherton has within the context of the decision to remove him. There are no other safeguards in place to ensure that his rights are vindicated.
There's some safeguards in the sense of if someone indicted by this grand jury gets word of it, which is an iffy proposition, obviously, but still, if such a person does get word of it and believes there's been a skewing of the process, that person can move to dismiss the indictment on that ground.
That's true, Your Honor, but that the secrecy of grand jury proceedings, which I believe you were alluding to, magnifies the risk that a person indicted by a grand jury where this takes place would not catch wind of it. They would not find out about it. So the secrecy makes it even more important that a juror dismissed in this manner be able to file a lawsuit and that absolute immunity not bar that lawsuit.
So how would this work? Say it were a judge here. Grand juror is excluded or removed. The judge has to go to trial. And that's what your ultimate position is, right?
Yes, unless this court were to find that the
cross-examined at trial about the reasons for removing a grand juror.
Yes, there would be potentially, depending on what the exact function at issue was or what the facts. What the facts indicated, there would be a potential for qualified immunity in a given situation. So it's not that automatically the judge would be subject to suit, because there is the alternative and more common qualified immunity that would exist. I'd also just like to address
And the judge is personally liable, right, for the damages?
Yes, Your Honor, unless this court were to find that a judge performing this function, because it would be a slightly different function, would be entitled to absolute immunity. Mm-hmm. Now, I'd also like to address a point raised just a moment ago about whether deliberative views were at issue here. It's clear from Mr. Atherton's complaint that that deliberative views were at issue. He asserts that he was removed because of his views on the merit, because of his thoroughness of deliberation, because of his meticulousness. He was demanding additional information.
He indicates that's his view of his quarrel with his fellow grand jurors. What is it that connects that with the defendants here in his allegations?
Well, in his allegations, he on pages 18 and 19 of the joint appendix, he alleges that the defendants conspired to remove him because of his meticulous nature or deliberation and or ethnicity. The problem here is that because no hearing was held.
There are also specific allegations, right?
Yes, there are specific allegations. I mean,
conspired to and so forth and so on. That's seems not all. There are quite a few specific allegations, and there's not much of a connection between the specific allegations and that grand wrap-up allegation.
There are inferences that are required, but it's important to note here that Mr. Atherton doesn't have a lot of information about exactly what the decision was based on. The whole problem is that no hearing was held. He was never given the specific reasons for his removal. He was told that it was generally because of his disruptiveness. Word was given to him after he had already been removed. But the whole problem is that no hearing was held to determine whether his removal was based on a permissible reason, such as being disruptive, or an impermissible reason, such as his views on the merits of the case or his demand for additional information so that he could do more than just rubber stamp what the prosecutor was telling him. And that's the problem. And that's why Mr. Atherton is bringing this lawsuit, to ensure that additional procedural safeguards are afforded and that the independence of the grand jury isn't threatened. Are there further questions, Your Honor?
Thank you. Mr. Coleman and Ms. Campbell, you were appointed by the court to participate as amicus, and in your briefs, and Ms. Campbell at oral argument, you've done a superb job, and the court thanks you. Thank you.
think so.
Isn't that it?
It is, but I don't think he takes it.
You sure?
Yeah.
The pen?